Well, that was Guns N' Roses' Mr. Brownstone. And those of you who are longtime listeners will know that that is the opening song. After that song, I come on and start talking. And I gotta say, I'm kind of in a bad mood today. Go outside, try to start my car, and of course it doesn't start, although it did turn over, and that always pisses me off. It means a problem I got to deal with. I think the cold ran down the battery. Nevertheless, leaving my personal problems aside, let's deal with some of the greater social problems we have today. I'm probably going to run only an hour or two today. Try to condense it. I don't feel like talking for hours and hours on end today. And I didn't come on Tuesday. I simply was too sluggish to speak. And if I can't do it right, I'm not going to do it. But I will come in next Tuesday. Tuesday, 1 p.m. is always the plan. Sometimes we don't achieve that, but always either later Tuesday or on Thursday, we'll do it. And we've done it, I don't know how many we've done in a row. We've done at least about 10 weeks in a row. Good 2-3 hours a week, probably about a 3-hour average. And we give you the kind of intellectual discussion you're really not going to find anywhere else. You're certainly not going to find it in a college where you might theoretically or hypothetically expect it, but of course the only thing you'll get in a college is some version of Marxism, Freudianism, or some other kind of neoliberal garbage. Now what we want to talk about today is just I think what we're going to discuss will be the dumbing down of the public and the role that public schools play in this. And there's a good bit of history in the latest Culture Wars magazine. Culture Wars is a magazine published by and largely written by E. Michael Jones out of South Bend, Indiana. He's kind of a one-man gang or one-man band when it comes to putting out media. And you'll be familiar from past Radio Astinas. We discuss his articles, and usually there's a good bit of history, and he has a good bit of 20th century history in his review of a book called Brooklyn Existentialism in the latest October 2008 issue of Culture Wars. I encourage you to visit culturewars.com and read some of the background articles. And if you want to learn more, it's one of the few magazines, it's edited by a traditional Catholic, that I would personally subscribe to if I were a magazine subscriber, which I'm not. I don't subscribe to any. Because all I get in magazines is garbage. I happen to see Time Magazine this week described segregation laws relating to Jim Crow as atrocity. Called them an atrocity. Now when white kids are raped, tortured, and murdered, that doesn't even get covered. But laws designed to protect whites from those who commit crimes against them, namely the niggers loosed by the Jewish communist revolutionaries in the 60s, why it's called an atrocity. White self-protection is only an atrocity in the eyes of the Jews who run our country. And they run it through figureheads. Now, those figureheads may be white like George Bush, or they may be black like Barack Obama, but never do they have anything other than their own particular, peculiar ethnic interests at heart and in mind. And never do they have any but their own ethnic agenda being pushed. And that agenda is always, uniformly, cross centuries, anti-white. And the only way to resist them is from a white racial basis. Race alone gives us the strength and the tool and the understanding we need to fight back against the Jew who sets up the system that so many make their living opposing. But most of the seeming opposition to the current order of things is nominal only, or seeming only, but in reality it's part of the system, it's a prop to the system. I'm talking about the conservatives. They are part of the system they claim to abhor and wish to obstruct. Although at this point, they've pretty much given away the game. Now that McCain has lost so thumpingly, They're not even pretending anymore to be the party of smaller government or to represent conservatism, true, or to represent whites' interests. They're saying we're going to be down for the count unless we embrace the new coming majority, which is non-white. So unless they become a Me Too socialist brown majority party, they have no future. Now, I wrote all this back in 97. I'm sure there were people who wrote it before me. Unless you fight on the white racial basis to protect our rights, then you have no intellectual leg to stand on in resisting the multiculturalist who claim that people are simply individuals and they can come from anywhere and it doesn't matter. Well, we're seeing the results of that. Dumbed down, bankrupt, Jew-run country. We have to move forward to sense. And sense is we whites are not like these other people. We need to live among our own in order to protect our own and to live the way we want to live. And it requires no deeper or greater justification than that. Why do we allow Jews among us? Why do we allow Jews to stick blacks among us and browns among us? Why do we allow Jews to run our government? Has anything good come from that? Of course not. Now, what we want to talk about, as I said today, is the dumbing down of the public manifest through the public schools, their rise from, say, 1850 until today. Before then, we didn't have public schools. Basic idea here is that in Prussia, they created a system to ensure that the average person would be unintellectual rather than developing whatever capacity he had for truly intellectual thought. They trained him to be a cog in their system, whether their commercial system or their army or their bureaucracy. And only the top 1% or so were given genuine intellectual education, that is, taught to see things as a whole, to see patterns and shapes the way someone intelligent or trained does. They wanted the lower people not to be concerned with the why, but just to worry about what they were told to do and to do it. In this way, they would conform and serve the powers that were. And a lot of the Americans, the WASP elite here, went over to Germany back in those times, back in the 1800s, and they learned that Prussian model. They came back to America, and they put it into our public schools. And that became the basis of our public schools. And it really got amped up around the turn of the 1900, when you had the crossover interest between the progressives, so-called, who had their own political fetishes and their own political agenda, and you had the giant corporations. Essentially, these had a mutual interest in crushing or snuffing the bright individual mind. They didn't want a bunch of Thomas Alva Edisons, who was basically an atheist, trained at home with very little formal schooling, and yet taught how to think. They didn't want that type because it offered competition with them, either for political or commercial leadership. So they snuffed it out by devising public schools in which kids were trained to respond to bells, they were trained to seek approval, they were trained to hold the right attitudes. They were trained to be obedient. They were trained to worship the state. All this was good for the top politicians, and it was good for the large commercial firms. And a variant of that is what we have today, except today it's serving an overtly Jewish agenda, promoting the Holocaust as a religion, even though it's not based in any facts, promoting sexual deviancy, sexual looseness, promiscuity as a way to break down the morals of society at the same time that their mind is being shackled. So they will become essentially a group of free fucking non-thinking animals, the better to serve the Jewish corporate behemoths and to serve Zog proper, whether as cannon fodder or consumers. And that's all they want from you. You have no other reason to exist, to buy their products and to fight their wars. You as an independent being with your own agenda, your own shopping agenda, your own ideas. They don't want that. They want you to be just like everybody else. And they want to force you to be just like everybody else. Now, let's get into it. We're not going to have a lot of long, rambling discursions today. We'll start by looking at, we'll look at a article written by the late mass popular writer Michael Crichton. He was the guy behind ER, the television show, and he also Jurassic Park. And he wrote, I don't know, 20 or 30 different mass novels. And they're interesting because he didn't really write about characters. It's very shallow stuff. But he was a guy who was trained as a doctor. He was an actual MD. So he actually knew something. He had some basis for writing. He knew a lot of medicine and science. So each one of his popular novels, let's just say compared to like a Dean Koontz or something, he actually had something to write about. So that his books were, and I've read almost all of them, are actually pretty interesting. And he just died recently of cancer at the age of 66. And one thing I noted in some of the obituaries, they claim that he wrote 10,000 words a day, which is absolutely incredible. The most I'd ever seen claimed for a writer was Mencken writing about 5,000 words a day. And believe me, 5,000 words is a lot of writing. A lot of writing. Your average syndicated column is maybe 700, 750 words. Which isn't much. And these guys are writing, you know, 5, 6, 7 times that, or in Crichton's case, 10, 12 times that a day. So that shows you how fecund somebody can be who's truly on the ball, working hard. Impressive. Now, let's see. Crichton wrote stuff like he wrote the Andromeda Strain. But one recent interesting thing about him is that he turned against global warming and decried that, as we're going to see in this essay here, as an example. This, we're going to talk about this essay as a specific example of where the public is now that it's been dumbed down by 100 years of stupid public schooling. And then we're going to go back to the root cause and go through the history as related by E. Michael Jones. And a lot of what he cites is a guy I've cited in earlier radio stations, John Taylor Gatto. Italian-German American from the Northeast, who is a public school teacher, an award-winning public school teacher for dozens of years, who himself has gone back and written, I think he calls it an underground history of American public education. I actually have a copy of that, and you might be able to find at least a chapter or two of it online. Very good stuff. And this is why you don't want your kid going to a public school. If you read and understand, you see what they are trying to make of him through these institutions. But let's start with an example of where we are now, and that would be global warming, or they've now shifted, since they can't prove the globe is actually warming, they shifted to climate change. And all this is Marxism in scientific garb, scientific drag. People don't respect Karl Marx. They don't respect Marxism, because socialism failed in every country in which it was tried by the Jews or people taking advice from them. That would be the Asians or the Cubans. So what the left has done is try to redress up its religion in the clothes of science, so that just as Jews always pursue an ethnic agenda behind a universal facade, the left, which is dominated by Jews and Jewish thinkers and Jewish ideologues and Jewish revolutionaries, always uses something respectable to hide the fact that it's just obnoxious ethnic politics advanced by dirty little kikes. The revolutionary scum of Europe, the scum of Europe's cities, empowered by money provided by the financial elite, the Jewish banksters, a Schiff backing a Lenin. So global warming is their latest attempt to foist their agenda on us, and they must necessarily hide it because the average person able to recognize it would reject it, and they know that. They can't proceed honestly because most people are against them. They're a tiny hated minority because what they advise is sick and wrong for 98% of us. So they must disguise it necessarily. I can't repeat that too often. Now, let's see here. This is posted at VNNforum.com, which I encourage you to join. Read our main news page, govnn.com, or go to our web forum, VNNforum.com. We've got a few thousand members. We have many intelligent people there, and we discuss matters like this around the clock. Now, As I said, Crichton, only at the end of his life did he get into this overtly political stuff. And in a lot of his novels, you'll find at least nods at political correctness, even though characters and character development is not his big thing. He's very, very male. He's interested in things and how they work rather than people. So you don't get the insights into human character you'd get from a female writer like Jane Austen. But what you get are neat little cameos or descriptions of how a virus works or how an airplane is built or all kinds of stuff like that. And just neat little glimpses. And he's a writer who actually knows something, which is always a good thing. A lot of writers don't know anything, and those are the ones who are obsessed with self-expression. But what's in you, if you're 999,999 out of a million, is not really very interesting. Anyway, towards the end of his life, he seemed to take on this political movement, and I actually saw him on an interview show. I can't remember where it was, but he said that basically he knew that global warming and all this was basically a big lie, but he feared to take it on. He thought, oh, I don't want to. And from what I've seen of him on video interviews, he's basically not a get-along, go-along guy, but he's someone who doesn't like a lot of controversy and that kind of stuff. So he backed away from it. But then I guess basically his Aryan character came through and he said, look, I have to address this. This is just flat wrong. The science that they're claiming underlies global warming simply doesn't. And so he went public with his objections and wrote a number of articles about it. Now what we're going to talk about is a speech he gave at the Commonwealth Club in 2003. We'll read a little of this and give this as an example of how dumbed down and religious-leftist the people pushing this stuff really are. He says, we must daily decide whether the threats we face are real, whether the solutions we are offered or will do any good, whether the problems we're told exist are in fact real problems or non-problems. And he's talking about perception and myth and reality and people's difficulty in making generalizations. Remember what I said about genuine intellectual education will teach you not only to observe very precisely, but it will also teach you to see shapes and holes, that is to generalize. And this ability has been deliberately undermined by public schools so that when you tell someone like, look, most, you know, blacks are extraordinarily violent compared to whites, well, I know some whites who are just as bad as blacks, is the usual response you'll be met with. And the reason for that is they've had that kind of pseudo-thinking trained into them as a good thing. But what it's doing, when you're crippling someone when you prevent them from observing what's going on, because speaking about honest perceptions becomes taboo. If it's taboo and you can't think, then you can't solve the problem. But of course, it's not a problem if the powers that be want it that way. It's a good thing for them. It's a good thing for them to have blacks marauding through society. It's a good thing for them to have laws discriminating against whites. It's a good thing for them to mock us as rednecks and retards and Klansmen and the rest of the gamut of descriptors they use in their media while talking about hate. So they don't want anyone making the observations that we make here in Radio Astina. It's not in their interest. He says, well, he says a lot of things, but let's try to find here the essentially what he's saying is the people pushing global warming have a religious belief in it. Cannot be sustained by factual study of the matter. And he even starts off, here's something that his type usually is loath to say. He says, what about the indigenous people living in a state of harmony with the Eden-like environment? Well, they never did. He's saying what Mel Gibson showed in Apocalypto. They were violent cannibals before white European Christian man arrived. He says, on this continent, the newly arrived people who crossed the land bridge almost immediately set out wiping out hundreds of species of large animals, and they did this several thousand years before the white man showed up to accelerate the process. And what was the condition of life? Loving, peaceful, and harmonious? Hardly. The early peoples of the New World lived in a state of constant warfare. generations of hatred, tribal hatreds, constant battles. The warlike tribes of this continent are famous: the Comanche, the Sioux, Apache, Mohawk, Aztecs, Toltec, Incas. Some of them practiced infanticide and human sacrifice. And those tribes that were not fiercely warlike were exterminated, or learned to build their villages high in the cliffs to attain some measure of safety. Remember, they found in essentially fossilized Anastasi turds, they found human remains. So they were eating each other and sacrificing each other, and they love to depict it as the whites came to this continent in 1492 and messed up this Eden. But in fact, the Indians themselves were not one people. They were divided into hundreds or thousands of tribes who were more or less always at war with each other. How about the human condition in the rest of the world? The Maori of New Zealand committed massacres regularly. The Dayaks of Borneo were headhunters. The Polynesians, living in an environment as close to paradise as one can imagine, fought constantly and created a society so hideously restrictive that you could lose your life if you stepped in the footprint of a chief. Says Crichton, it was the Polynesians who gave us the very concept of taboo. That's true, it is a Polynesian word, as well as the word itself. The noble savage is a fantasy, and it was never true. That anyone still believes it 200 years after Rousseau shows the tenacity of religious myths, their ability to hang on in the face of centuries of factual contradiction. Well, there's a little more than that. It's actually that the people who own and run our society have an interest in propagating these myths. And so, regardless of their refutation, they keep on with it. And they censor material that doesn't reflect their false view. He says, and this is interesting, there was even an academic movement during the latter 20th century that claimed that cannibalism was a white man's invention to demonize the indigenous peoples. Only academics could fight such a battle. It was some 30 years before the professors finally agreed that, yes, cannibalism does indeed occur among human beings. Meanwhile, all during this time, New Guinea Highlanders in the 20th century continued to eat the brains of their enemies until they were finally made to understand that they risked kuru, a fatal neurological disease, when they did so. He says, more recently, still, the Genetacidae of the Philippines turned out to be a publicity stunt. A non-existent tribe, and African pygmies have one of the highest murder rates on the planet. And you'll remember also Margaret Mead, who was the disciple of a Jew, the Jew who founded social anthropology and set up the big lie that race does not exist, and propagated that across the U.S. as his disciples farmed out and established academic anthropology schools of their own. And it's in the Jew's interest to teach the white man that they are at war with, that his race does not exist, that all races and cultures are equal, and thereby to give away their uniquely valuable culture and think little to nothing of it, or think even that it's a negative rather than a positive. This is the price we pay for allowing Jews among us. And Margaret Mead, of course, was famous for her work abroad, and she wrote that these, I can't remember the people she worked among, but it was somewhere over there in the South Pacific, and free love was common among them, except she claimed that was the basis, or that was what she found, but in fact they were pulling her leg, and she repeated it, and the Jewish professors, I'm sure, knew it wasn't true, but they promoted that idea in order to break down Western sexual morality, which had always been get married and then have sex and kids, rather than loose sex and positive homosexuality. But the Jews did their work so well in taking over the media and the culture, the law schools, and the academic disciplines that today most people who consider them educated are simply repeating Jewish big lies. And these big lies are backed not just by law or not just by college professors, but they're backed by law and the media, so that you can have, as we do today, sexual deviants marching around assaulting people outside churches because the mass of common people is still smart enough to vote against, say, homosexual marriage. And as I speak, the fags are up in arms and they're going after the Mormon Church because it helped lead the opposition to, I think, Proposition 8 in California, which would have allowed faggots to marry. even though by definition faggots can't marry. So, academia, more precisely the Jews who either founded or took over these different disciplines upon arriving in America in the late 1800s, or late 1900s and early 20th century, is deliberately propagating a number of big lies, all of them aimed at destroying white Christian America. But even the people who oppose the symptoms created by these Jews won't get to the root of the problem, the real disease. The real disease is the fact that the Jews are a group at war with ordinary whites. They don't like our kind. That's the reason we do this radio show, to fight back and teach you how you're being lied to by the Jews, to demonstrate that. And just as they like to cripple our minds in public schools, they want to cripple our industry by imposing their socialism on it. And their essentially religious, dishonest, unfact-backed view of climate change as a way to smuggle in their Marxist doctrines, which they know we wouldn't buy under their original name. Now, this is the part I like. He says, the truth is almost nobody wants to experience real nature. And this is a point I make even to many of the so-called Nazis, is nature worship is ridiculous in any form, because nature has at least as many things that are negative and nasty as it does things that are positive. The fact that we have to respect nature's laws doesn't mean we have to like them or admire them, let alone worship them. We just have to observe them. No, we don't even have to do that, but if we don't, unlike human law, we can't break nature's laws and get away with it. So that's it's due respect according to understanding reality, but beyond that, it's not due any particular respect. Nature is full of chiggers, ticks, thorns, sawgrass that will cut you if you move through it. There's plenty of things about nature that are not to be liked. He says, the truth is almost nobody wants to experience real nature. What people want to do is spend a week or two in a cabin in the woods with screens on the windows. They want a simplified life for a while without all their stuff. Or a nice river rafting trip for a few days with somebody else doing the cooking. Nobody wants to go back to nature in any real way, and nobody does. It's all talk. As the years go on and the world population grows incredibly urban, or increasingly urban, it's uninformed talk. Farmers know what they are talking about. City people don't. It's all fantasy. One way to measure the prevalence of the fantasy is to note the number of people who die because they haven't the least knowledge of what nature really is. They stand beside wild animals like buffalo for a picture and get trampled to death. They climb a mountain in dicey weather without proper gear and freeze to death. They drown in the surf on holiday because they can't conceive the real power of what we blithely call the force of nature. They have seen the ocean, but they haven't been in it. That's true, even on a sunlit day. I came close to that myself. My sister and I were out in the apparently calm surf. It can kill you very, very easily. You have to be very, very careful of it. Any place with an undertow. The television generation expects nature to act the way they want it to be. They think all life experience can be TiVo'd. The notion that the natural world obeys its own rules and doesn't give a damn about your expectations comes as a massive shock. Well-to-do educated people in an urban environment experience the ability to fashion their daily lives as they wish. They buy clothes that suit their taste and decorate their apartments as they wish. Within limits, they can contrive a daily urban world that pleases them, but the natural world is not so malleable. On the contrary, it will demand that you adapt to it, and if you don't, you die. It is a harsh, powerful, and unforgiving world that most urban Westerners have never experienced. Anyway, let's see here. He says, and here's an example of overpopulation fears. He says, well, it's interesting. You may have noticed that something has been left off the doomsday list lately. Although the preachers of environmentalism have been yelling about population for 50 years, over the last decade, world population seems to be taking an unexpected turn. Fertility rates are falling almost everywhere. As a result, over the course of my lifetime, the thoughtful predictions for total world population have gone from a high of 20 billion to 15 billion to 11 billion, which was the UN estimate around 1990, to now 9 billion, and soon perhaps less. There are some who think that world population will peak in 2050 and then start to decline. There are some who predict we will have fewer people in 2100 than we do today. Is this a reason to rejoice, to say hallelujah? Certainly not. Without a pause, we now hear about the coming crisis of the world economy from a shrinking population. We hear about the impending crisis of an aging population. Nobody anywhere will say that the core fears expressed for most of my life have turned out not to be true. As we have moved into the future, these doomsday visions have vanished like a mirage in the desert. They were never there, though they still appear in the future, as mirages do. Okay, he says, so the preachers made a mistake. They got one prediction wrong. They're human. So what? Unfortunately, it's not just one prediction. It's a whole slew of them. We are running out of oil. We are running out of all natural resources. Paul Ehrlich, 60 million Americans will die of starvation in the 1980s. 40,000 species become extinct every year. Half of all species on the planet will be extinct by 2000. And on and on. With so many past failures, you might think that environmental predictions would become more cautious. But not if it's a religion. Remember, the nut on the sidewalk carrying the placard that predicts the end of the world doesn't quit when the world doesn't end on the day he expects. He just changes his placard, sets a new doomsday date, and goes back to walking the streets. One of the defining features of religion is that your beliefs are not troubled by facts because they have nothing to do with facts. He says, so I can tell you some facts. I know you haven't read any of what I'm about to tell you in the newspaper because the newspapers literally don't report them. I can tell you that DDT is not a carcinogen and did not cause birds to die and should not have never have been banned. I can tell you that the people who banned it knew that it wasn't carcinogenic, that is, cancer-causing, and banned it anyway. I can tell you that the DDT ban has caused the deaths of tens of millions of people, of poor people, mostly children, whose deaths are directly attributable to a callous, technologically advanced Western society that promoted the new cause of environmentalism by pushing a fantasy about a pesticide, and thus irrevocably harmed the Third World. Banning DDT is one of the most disgraceful episodes in the 20th century history of America. We knew better, and we did it anyway, and we let people around the world die, and we didn't give a damn. And here he says, I can tell you that secondhand smoke is not a health hazard to anyone and never was, and the EPA has always known it. I can tell you that the evidence for global warming is far weaker than its proponents would admit. I can tell you the percentage of the U.S. land area that is taken by urbanization, including cities and roads, is 5%. I can tell you that the Sahara Desert is shrinking, and the total ice of Antarctica is increasing. I can tell you that a blue ribbon panel in Science magazine concluded there is no known technology that will enable us to halt the rise of carbon dioxide in the 21st century. Not wind, not solar, not even nuclear. The panel concluded a totally new technology like nuclear fusion was necessary, otherwise nothing could be done, and in the meantime, all efforts would be a waste of time. They said that when the UN IPCC report stated alternative technologies existed that could control greenhouse gases, the UN was wrong. I can, with a lot of time, give you the factual basis for these views. I can cite the appropriate journal articles, not in wacko magazines, but in the most prestigious science journals, such as Science and Nature. But such references probably won't impact more than a handful of you, because the beliefs of religion are not dependent on facts, but rather are matters of faith, unshakable belief. So, that's why we have a scams forum at vnnforum.com. We have a scam subs forum in which we have stuff like secondhand smoke listed. And what he's doing here is showing that only one form of religious fundamentalism is denounced in the U.S. and in the media. But those media themselves, at the behest of the Jews, embrace an entirely different fundamentalism that is just as unfounded in anything objective other than Jewish interest. Jewish interest in destroying white Western society is the prime motivator behind our politicians and our media, and virtually every official authority out there that the mass of you follow without thinking, because most Aryans accept things at face value rather than questioning them. And you want to believe the best people, and you're taught to follow the golden rule and treat others as you want to be treated. What if others aren't like you? What if they're different? What if they enjoy harming people? What if they belong to a different race or ethnic group, and their interest lies directly counter to yours? What about that? And so what he's doing here fits very naturally into racialist thinking, because everything that he says could be applied directly to racialism. It's like there's a religious belief in human equality, political, social, moral, and legal equality, and thus any observed differences on stuff that matters can only be attributed to some imaginary religious cause like racism. Racism being the invention of a left-wing kike named Trotsky, Lev Bronstein. Trotsky, one of the original communists, invented the term racialism. Racism. Racism was first promoted by a deviant Jew sexologist, that is, masquerading as a scientist, but really he was a homosexual pervert, Magnus Hirschfeld in Germany, first popularized the term racism. Now it's ubiquitous. That means everywhere at the same time. All the media, it's a defining feature of our life, is cries and complaints about racism everywhere. But it's nothing but a political agitprop term, a religious term. It's based on a religious view of the world that doesn't fit the facts. Crichton says, most of us have had some experience interacting with religious fundamentalists, and we understand that one of the problems with fundamentalists is that they have no perspective on themselves. They never recognize that their way of thinking is just one of many other ways of thinking, which may be equally useful or good. On the contrary, they believe that their way is the right way, everyone else is wrong. They are in the business of salvation, and they want to help you see things in the right way. They want to help you be saved. They are totally rigid and totally uninterested in opposing points of view. In our modern complex world, fundamentalism is dangerous because of its rigidity and its imperviousness to other ideas. And here's the beautiful part about objective facts or truth, is that you can lay something out that doesn't depend on your own whim or your own opinion. It can be demonstrated to be true. You understand? And this is essentially, realistic thinking is essentially characteristic of the right, whereas fantasy thinking is characteristic of the left. They can't prove their case or make it in any other than religious fundamentalist terms. The irony there is that they're always denouncing right-wing Christian fundamentalists for imposing their morality on others, yet that is precisely what white leftists do. Notice I make the distinction between white leftist and Jews. The Jews are pursuing their own objective, well, more or less objective, ethnic interest. So, from that point of view, as bad as it is for us normal whites, it's still reasonable. It can still be explained and understood. But for the white leftists, they are forever hunting heretics and censoring them and silencing them. Because they can't demonstrate what they say is true, they have to force people to go along with it. Most people are at least open enough to evidence that they can be persuaded that the leftists are wrong. Therefore, the leftists will never be the majority. They'll always be a minority. And to exercise, to turn their beliefs into power, they have to actively attack and suppress the other side. Because the other side can make a very good case, and a case that will be persuasive to most people. This is why people who wish to impose their view of the world that is counterfactual and against the interests of the mass of people have to control the media. Otherwise, they don't have a shot in the world. If they play fairly, objectively, the way that we are supposed to play and the way that right-wing people generally do, they will lose. They don't have a case. Most people take homosexuality. Most people think it's disgusting, unnatural, and nasty. They think fags are inherently ludicrous. The idea of them marrying is laughable. And there are many objective reasons for holding that view, based on fags being screwed up psychologically and physically. They don't want that spread. It's not good stuff. We want less of it. We don't want it in public. We want it behind closed doors, if at all. Most people understand and know that instinctively. You don't even have to make a case for it, although you can make 1,000 cases for it. So, in order to get homosexuality accepted, this tiny minority of people, maybe the 1% that are homos themselves, and the handful of percent that support them for their own perverse reasons, well, they have to control the loudspeaker. And they have to yell at everybody else nonstop, and they have to keep other views away from anything that will amplify them in order to put it across that they are the normal ones or that we ought to accept their point of view. Do you understand this point? It's essential. You always get right-wingers whining about media bias. That's not the basis of it. It's not bias. Bias can be cleared up by the facts. Now, don't ever doubt the left knows what it's doing. It must suppress criticism. It must seek out and smash heretics. It must burn witches. Otherwise, it doesn't have a chance. That's the only game it has, is suppression of others. Mislabeling their motives, questioning their motives, questioning their character, questioning their sanity. That's all the left has. That's all the fanatists have. That's all the Jewish activists, the people motivated by their big lies, the insane white leftist dupes. That's all they have. The evidence isn't on their side. The mass of people aren't on their side. The only thing they have on their side, which is enough, in many instances, is the law, the academy, the mass media. By controlling the high points, they were able to inflict their sickness, their loxism, that is, their hatred of white people, ordinary, normal white people, on the rest of us. The Jews are the only people who control the media or have to. You and I don't have to control the media, right? Except in self-defense. They have to control the media to get their point across, because no one will accept it, because there's no logical, reasonable, rational case for it. Everything the Jew-organized, Jew-run, Jew-created left has to offer is bad. Bad for you as a white individual, bad for your white family, bad for your white town, city, community, bad for your nation, bad for your state. Everything they have to offer is bad, sick, and destructive. So they have to control the government. They have to control the media. They have to control the academy. They have to poison every possible well from which you might drink. Whenever you come to an official authority, it's going to be controlled by the left to the extent they possibly can. And if it's not controlled yet, they're going to be trying to subvert it. Messing white people up, wrecking nations, is what Jews do. Global warming is just one of the various points on their agenda. Just another way of messing things up, messing up our industrial civilization. Their leftist politics, just the way they mess up our culture by promoting bogus doctrines. And so Crichton says, and note that the timing of this change is the same as the timing for every other major change in American society in the mid-60s to the mid-70s. So that's when the laws and the culture were really overhauled by the Jews, and everything was rewritten to advance the Jews' agenda and anti-white normalcy. He says, I want to argue that now is the time for us to make a major shift in our thinking about the environment, similar to the shift that occurred around the first Earth Day in 1970, when this awareness was first heightened. But this time around, we need to get environmentalism out of the sphere of religion. We need to stop the mythic fantasies, and we need to stop the doomsday predictions. We need to start doing hard science instead. He says, there are two reasons I think we need to get rid of the religion of environmentalism. First, we need an environmental movement, and such a movement is not very effective if it is conducted as religion. And this is what I've long said. I've said, there are problems with the environment, but the whole thing has to be discussed scientifically and rationally and made into a matter in which both sides compromise, rather than treat it as a religious thing in which there are good people who want to love and save the environment and bad people who want to destroy it. Says Crichton, we know from history that religions tend to kill people, and environmentalism has already killed somewhere between 10 and 30 million people since the 70s. It's not a good record. Environmentalism needs to be based in objective and verifiable science. It needs to be rational, and it needs to be flexible. And it needs to be apolitical. To mix environmental concerns with frantic fantasies that people have about one political party or another is to miss the cold truth, that there is very little difference between the parties, except a difference in pandering rhetoric. The effort to promote effective legislation for the environment is not helped by thinking the Democrats will save us and the Republicans won't. Political history is more complicated than that. Never forget which president started the EPA, Richard Nixon, and never forget which president sold federal oil leases allowing oil drilling in Santa Barbara, Lyndon Johnson. So get politics out of your thinking about the environment. The second reason to abandon environmental religion is more pressing. Religions think they know it all, but the unhappy truth of the environment is that we are dealing with incredibly complex, evolving systems, and we usually are not certain how best to proceed. Those who are certain are demonstrating their personality type or their belief system, not the state of their knowledge. Our record in the past, for example, managing national parks, is humiliating. Remember them burning down Yellowstone. Our 50-year effort at forest fire suppression is a well-intentioned disaster from which our forest will never recover. We need to be humble, deeply humble, in the face of what we are trying to accomplish. We need to be trying various methods of accomplishing things. We need to be open-minded about assessing results of our effort. And we need to be flexible about balancing needs. Religions are good at none of these things. How will we manage to get environmentalism out of the clutches of religion and back to a scientific discipline? There's a simple answer. We must institute far more stringent requirements for what constitutes knowledge in the environmental realm. I am thoroughly sick of politicized organizations spinning their case to present it in the strongest way. Not at all. What more and more groups are doing is putting out is lies, pure and simple. Falsehoods that they know to be false. And it's the same thing with race as it is with environmentalism. Deliberate lying that IQ does not exist, that there's no way to measure intelligence. This trend began with the DDT campaign and persists to this day. At the moment, the EPA is hopelessly politicized. In the wake of Carol Browner, it is probably better to shut it down and start over. What we need is a new organization much closer to the FDA. We need an organization that will be ruthless about acquiring verifiable results, that will fund identical research projects to more than one group, that will make everybody in this field get honest fast. Because in the end, science offers us the only way out of politics, and if we allow science to become politicized, then we are lost. We will enter the internet version of the Dark Ages, an era of shifting fears and wild prejudices transmitted to people who don't know any better. That's not a good future for the human race. That's our past, so it's time to abandon the religion of environmentalism and return to the science of environmentalism and base our public policy decisions firmly on that. And that's the conclusion of the speech he gave in 2003 to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. I'm not familiar with the Commonwealth Club, but turning from that, let's move on to the E. Michael Jones article, and we'll talk about the dumbing down in public schools that has been caused and championed by the left in order to produce the type of people who are susceptible to the left-wing environmentalist religious fantasies that Crichton, the late Michael Crichton, described. Now, I'm not sure if we'll get through this entire article today, but we'll go at least another half hour. This will be a little shorter show than our usual, but what we have here in front of us is a review of a book called Brooklyn Existentialism, Voices from the Stoop Explaining How Philosophical Realism Can Bring About the Restoration of Character, Intelligence, and Taste. And that's published by Fidelity Press out of South Bend, Indiana. I don't know if this is a book published by Jones's company or Jones himself, but in any case, it's a book that's he's in sympathy with philosophically, and it's a book he reviews in the October 2008 number of Culture Wars magazine. Find that at culturewars.com. Now, his stuff is not online. I'm just going to discuss his article. And again, this is one of my favorite topics. We've discussed it on earlier Radio Astina's, the background and history of public schooling, in order to know what you're getting into when you send your kids to a public school and understand the people who set these schools up and what their motivation was. Jones begins by talking about he trained his son. Remember, Jones is he publishes a magazine, he publishes his own books, he publishes his own CDs and videotapes of his lectures and CDs of the songs that he sings. Well, he plays in a band that plays at this Irish bar in South Bend, Indiana. That's where Notre Dame is. And he goes a lot to Central Europe, to Germany and Czechoslovakia and Central Europe, and talks to different Catholic people over there. He's a very big Catholic. He says he took his son Sam Jones to Germany for the Roots Conference in Rees, R-E-E-S, in 2004. He says, I made him take his fiddle. I also made him memorize a little speech in German by way of introduction. Mein Name ist Sam Jones. Ich bin 13 Jahre alt. Ich bin nie zur Schule gegangen, aber ich spiele Geige jeden Montagabend in einer Kneipe. My name is Sam Jones. I'm 13 years old. I don't go to a public school, but I play a fiddle every Monday evening in a bar. So he says, I thought this was a humorous way for Sam to introduce himself to the Germans. The Germans, however, failed to see the humor in what Sam was saying. Instead of bursting out laughing, a look of concern would invariably come over the German's face, and he, usually she, most of the time, would invariably ask something like, "Darf man das? Is one allowed to do that?" Remember, we've talked on earlier shows about homeschooling being illegal in Germany? That is a law put in by the National Socialist, but it was a law kept by Democratic Germany. They don't want anybody teaching anything against the official state ideology. Think about it. We already know that Germany is a conquered land and it's owned and run by the Jews, and people like Merkel are simply puppets of the Jews, and they enforce an official ideology dealing not only with present-day stuff but with history, so that anybody who Volksverhetzung, who heats up the folk, or anybody who casts doubt on the official myth of the Holocaust gets thrown in jail. They even try to jail foreigners who print stuff on the web, as we've seen in the case of the Australian, German-born Australian, Friedrich Tobin, who recently won at least a bond release from being extradited to Germany after being taken off of a British airplane that landed in England while he was en route somewhere in the Middle East. So the Germans, the idea of free schooling or free thinking is foreign to them now after decades of Jewish oppression. What followed was a little speech about how homeschooling was not permitted in Germany. So he thinks this introduction will be funny for his son to give in German to the people at conference, and instead it just gives the Germans quizzical looks. They don't understand the concept of raising your kid at home, because it's illegal in Germany. And WorldNet Daily tracks this, as do we at VNNForum.com in our learning section. We have a number of different threads about homeschooling resources and the latest battles between homeschoolers and the feds and the state governments and the anti-white left. So you can get up to speed very quickly at VNN Forum, because we have this kind of material that I'm talking about today archived in easy-to-research form. Since many of Sam's interlocutors were school teachers, the response was not surprising. After a while, he, dismayed by the reaction, he refused to give the little speech anymore. Rather than seeing the speech as a denigration of education in America, which of course it was, I saw it as praise of America's bars, or at least as praise of Fiddler's Hearth, the Irish pub at South Bend where I play regularly. And if you're in South Bend, go there. It's very neat. It's filled with lots of attractive young white people. Fiddler's Hearth, South Bend. Fiddler's Hearth has done more to resurrect local culture than the combined budgets of every school district within a 100-mile radius of where we live. But even more than that, Sam's speech was a tribute to his mother, who taught him how to read and compute and do all the other things for which the education establishment in Indiana gets paid millions of dollars. So much money, in fact, that public schooling is currently in the process of bankrupting both the state and local economies. Again, that's what your property tax is used for, to pay for public schools, which are set up by your enemies, to inculcate your own offspring and turn them against you. There's a long leftist history of believing that children are resources of the state and must be trained to serve state interest. They must be ripped away from their parents as early as possible and taught that everything their parents taught them is wrong. That's the purpose of public schooling. As a belated recognition of her effort, Sam received a letter in June 2008 from Harvard University asking him to apply there. Since Sam's mother got no recognition in the letter, but now instead of Germans with worried looks on their faces, Sam was listening to Harvard offer him, quote, congratulations on your academic achievements, quote, and encouraging him to consider the opportunities available at Harvard as you plan your academic future. It was as if attendants from the King's Palace had showed up with a glass slipper at Sam's door and were ready to whisk him off to the palace once he went through the formality of trying it on. Quote, there has never been a more exciting time to be at Harvard, the letter continued breathlessly, especially since, quote, the university was now engaged in the study of the human genome and the formation of a center for stem cell research. At this point, the letter started to sound more like the invitation Harry Potter got to attend the Hogwarts School of Magic, the modern variant of Cinderella, which has become fantastically popular in cultures obsessed with academic credentials. Why the admissions department was giving potential undergraduates the impression that they might make some contribution to the genome project is anyone's guess, but if nothing else, it showed Harvard's ongoing commitment to biological determinism, the successor to Calvin's theological determinism at America's Athens on the Charles, that is, the Charles River in Boston, which runs by the Harvard campus, Anyway, so his son has been homeschooled. Joan's obviously a very bright guy, and so his kids are, too. And one of them went to Harvard, and Joan says, if I sound ungratefully flippant, it's because this wasn't the first time the Jones family received a letter from Harvard. My oldest son was a student there from 89 to 92, graduating in 3 years after getting absolved from taking freshman courses because of his achievement test scores. His experiences there, which I have written about at length elsewhere in these pages, taught us not to expect any magical Hogwartsian transformations as a result of attending classes there. I remember a graduation ceremony there, not Adams, at which all of the faculty members showed up carrying black balloons with the word diversity written on them. As far as I could tell, diversity in this instance meant racial mixing of the sort frowned upon by Harvard men in the first decades of the 20th century. It most certainly did not mean diversity of opinion, which my son and his largely Irish Catholic buddies from Boston discovered when they crossed the powers that be by publishing a series of articles questioning the virtue of sodomy, which at that point had just edged out gender equality as the summum bonum, the maximum good, on Harvard's campus. So Jones's Irish Catholic kid, who did go to Harvard 89 to 92, wrote stuff questioning the virtues of faggotry and was widely hated for that. What the summum bonum there is there now, I can't say, but I can say that Sam's letter was different than Adam's. The big news in Sam's letter wasn't the genome project. The big news had to do with money. Harvard had just engaged in a sweeping overhaul of financial aid policies designed to make Harvard College more affordable for families across the economic spectrum. This meant that parents with incomes of less than $60,000, my ears perked up at this point, are no longer expected to contribute to their children's Harvard College costs. So if your parents make under $60,000, you can get into Harvard free, provided they admit you. In addition to that, a new initiative announced in December 2007 eliminated all student loans and removed home equity from financial aid calculations. As if to show that great minds all run in the same circles, Sam's letter from Yale made exactly the same financial concession. If you are considering Yale, you should not hesitate because you will fear the cost will exceed your family's means. In January, we announced dramatic improvements to our financial aid policies in order to ensure that students will be able to attend Yale regardless of their family's financial circumstances. Families with annual incomes under $60,000 are no longer asked to contribute to the cost of sending a child to Yale. Those with incomes between $60,000 and $120,000 will pay from 1% to 9% of annual income, and families from $120,000 to $200,000 will pay an average of 10% of income. The contributions expected from student earnings has also been reduced, eliminating the need for students to borrow money to finance their education. Suddenly, says Jones, the Ivy League had my undivided attention. Maybe Yale was serious when it said that their aim was, quote, gathering the most extraordinary variety of talented and promising individuals, people who challenge one another with high aspirations and significant accomplishments. Maybe money wasn't the second most important issue at the Ivy League. The first indication of high seriousness I learned while hanging out at street corners in Philadelphia was a willingness to put your money where your mouth is. And here were Harvard and Yale expressing a willingness to do just that. In this they differed from Indiana University, where my daughter Sarah Jones is a classics major with a specialization in ancient Greek. Around the same time that Sam got his letter from Harvard, Sarah got a letter from IU offering her congratulations because of her outstanding academic performance during her sophomore year there. Unlike most of the offerings at the state universities, ancient Greek is a serious academic subject. Sarah had been placed on the College of Arts and Sciences Dean's List for the spring semester 2008 because of the high grade she had earned in that challenging subject, and so it was without irony that they told her, "You can be proud of your accomplishment." They even enclosed an announcement that she could send to her local newspaper if you wish to have this achievement published. What IU did not do, however, was show any serious willingness to put their money where their mouth was. Shortly after receiving the notice that she was on the dean's list, Sarah received a letter from the State Student Assistance Commission of Indiana concerning State of Indiana grant programs for full-time enrollment. Under award amount and name, Sarah received the deflatingly short announcement, "You do not show financial need according to state program rules." To be fair, the Classics Department at Indiana University gave Sarah their department scholarship, which was an honor to be sure, but the amount, $1,000, constituted today's prices, a proverbial drop in the bucket, for which we are nonetheless grateful. So what he's saying here is that Harvard and Yale have such endowments now that they can afford to give everybody they admit essentially a free ride, whereas at the state universities, you don't get a full ride. And he's going to go on to explain the philosophical background of this. I might say that one of ESPN's writers, Greg Easterbrook, who has a background writing for the New Republic, another sort of neoliberal or neocon magazines, has written about that these universities, Yale and Harvard and the other Ivy League, have huge endowments. I mean, literally in the billions, at least in a couple of the cases. And yet people continue to give money to them that might be better served if they gave it. It would actually be a lot more useful to different colleges which don't have nearly as high endowments. But nevertheless, people keep giving to Harvard and Yale because of the names and the publicity associated with it rather than the good that it might do. Jones says, "What Indiana University, an institution created by the state of Indiana and funded by state tax money, so that Indiana residents can send their children there at minimal cost, is really telling us is that it's time to take out one of those home equity loans, the kind with the hidden balloon payments in the middle that is driving the foreclosure crisis at the moment, so that we can finance our daughter's education. Or to state the case more precisely, so that we can finance the racket that education has become in the state of Indiana. By the mid-90s, tuition at places like Indiana University was increasing three times faster than household income and at a rate more than three times faster than the rate of inflation. In the past 10 years, those costs have continued to skyrocket, making the home equity loan a necessity for the average parent who wants to send his child to a state university, a system that was created to be affordable to the residents of states that created them. It was public education more than anything else that created the property tax crisis in the state of Indiana. So costs are going up. They're forcing parents to take home equity loans to send their kids to schools where they will be indoctrinated by Jew leftists. That's why we say you have to consider very carefully what you're buying, what you get when you undertake to pay for a college education, so-called. We have material on that at vnnforum.com under the scams sub-forum. After reading Sam's and Sarah's respective letters, the dirty secret in higher education in America slowly came into focus. The elites get an elite education which prepares them for top jobs in the American empire for free, but the proles have to pay through the nose to compete for third and fourth rank jobs and positions at third and fourth rank professional schools, burdening themselves, as John Taylor Gatto puts it, with debt burdens which enslave them and their children for many years to come. So the high-end institutions give free educations and get you into the very top tier of American society, but for average people they have to pay exorbitant rates taught by inferior teachers just to become cogs in the system. And what exactly is the intellectual difference between Sarah Jones and Sam Jones? What have they done to merit such radically different fates? Neither graduated from grade school. Both were taught by their mother at home during their most formative years. Both attended the same Catholic high school, where they had virtually the same set of courses taught by the same group of teachers. In the realm of 20th century social science, there are two major theories which purport to explain why Sam and Sarah are what they are, nurture and nature. Yet from either of those perspectives, be it biology or environment, they are virtually identical. Given that fact, why are their educational fates so radically different? The answer to that question is a three-letter acronym, SAT, short for Scholastic Aptitude Test, and here he's going to go into the whole history of this test, what it was intended to achieve. The reason Sam and Adam got a letter from Harvard and Sarah did not is the same, SAT scores. Sam's letter from Harvard said as much. As do many other colleges, we take advantage of the search services of the College Board and the American College Testing Program, that is the ACT, as well as the SAT, to identify students whose test scores and grades suggest they may be good candidates for our college. Sam's letter from Yale said pretty much the same thing. Using information obtained from the College Board and the ACT program, we have identified you as a student who may be a good candidate for Yale. Many other colleges will be writing to you as well, and I expect that you have already begun to amass a sizable collection of enticing letters and colorful brochures. John Taylor Gatto points out that from 1972 to 1979, there was a 50% decline in the number of students who scored over 750 in their SATs. If the number of students who scored over 750 in their SATs dropped at the same rate in the period from 1994 to 2008 as they did in the period of 1972 to 1994, Sam belongs to a cohort of around 900 students. So if he scored over 750, he's saying there's only maybe 1,000 people nationwide who are in that tiny class. If we factor in percentages out of a total population that has increased from 270 to 360 million, the size of the cohort is thrown into even greater relief. It's the top of the top of the top. If we factor in the fact that the test is dumbed down to save appearances, the numbers become more dramatic still, and that's true. The SAT did dumb itself down maybe 10, 15 years ago, I guess because they had declining numbers of people who were recording the very highest scores. SAT is a three-letter word meaning destiny. The score you attain in this test assigns you to your place in the American meritocracy. The people who score well at that test are invited to attend the most prestigious schools in the country. After they graduate, they used to get the first crack at the best jobs. Now they get first crack at the best graduate schools, which leads to the most prestigious, best-paying jobs. And yet, even at this date, long after the SATs have become an integral part of American life and a rite of passage for generations of Americans, no one is quite sure what answering word association, parlor game questions like flatulent is to bipolar as quixotic is to A, happy, B, sad, C, none of the above, D, all of the above measures, other than the ability to take this test. And yet, the big test, based on answers to questions like the above, has determined how destiny has been meted out for generations of Americans now, and judging from the letters from Harvard and Yale, will continue to be so into the indefinite future. In the upside-down world of higher education in America, actual achievement finishes a distant second to test-derived potential. So the fact that Sarah has actually distinguished herself in the eyes of the classics department at Indiana University by her skill in reading and writing ancient Greek means little to nothing when compared with Sam's skill at deciphering word association games of the sort that got played in the parlors of Chestnut Hill or the main line from, say, 1925 to 1945. The WASP graduates of places like Groton and Yale and Harvard, who designed our national intelligence test, admired folks who used big words. The best example of someone who epitomized that model of intelligence was Yale graduate William F. Buckley, who regularly astounded a nation of SAT takers by his quixotic polysyllabicality. Use of words with multiple syllables. Buckley's TV show, Firing Line, went on the air around the same time that the baby boomer cohort was starting to prepare for the big test. Buckley succeeded 50s paradigm Charles Van Doren of the $64,000 question, remember there was a movie made about that, as the model of an intelligent person largely because of his use of the kind of words that would end up in the verbal section of the SATs. but since Buckley came neither from a public school nor from the Midwest, he was not typical of the type of student Yale and Harvard sought during the period following World War II. If you delve into the history of the SAT, says Jones, you soon realize it was created with people like me and my children in mind. As the system stands now, the people with the highest SAT scores get to attend the nation's top universities for free. Those with scores lower down on the scale get to go to universities like Notre Dame, where they learn to be accountants and spies for the elite, that is, FBI agents. For this dubious privilege, they must pay between $40,000 and $50,000 per year, a figure which few families can afford. This means crushing debt for a graduate who is armed with a degree which will allow him to compete for the third and fourth tier positions in the American meritocratic empire. We have been asked to dedicate our lives to a system that no one, until very recently, has ever explained, and that is so for good reason, because if the system were explained clearly, no one would support it. And that's the substance of this article, is the history of the test and the reasons behind it and the type of system that it sustains and creates, or creates and sustains. And we're going to go another half hour, let's say. We'll probably have to finish this article next time, but it's quite instructive, and this is the system that you get into if you go to college. He's saying the high end have billion-dollar endowments, can afford to subsidize the education of the top elite. But the second tier has to pay itself. Or second, third, or fourth, however you want to put it, the people who go to the state schools and the Notre Dames, the large private schools that aren't quite as good as the Harvards and Yale and the Ivies, have to go into debt and pay their own way. And this, as a whole, functions as a system. Jones says, the system is now showing signs of strain. The decision at Harvard and Yale to change the way they charge for their degrees is a sign that money is now the main factor in higher education, and that many families were, reluctantly or not, willing to forego an education at top-ranked school because the economics of the deal no longer made any sense. The student loans that were introduced in the early 70s, under radically different circumstances, that is, a $5,000 government loan at 2% instead of the $100,000 that credit card rate charges banks are now charging for them, so allowed colleges and universities to raise their prices with no regard to the diminishing returns that college degrees were conferring. So I guess what they found is that as the price of these degrees has gone up, it's gotten to the point that even your admission to Harvard or Yale, even the fact you can go there, they will let you in, you can get a degree and have that name on your resume, even that does not counterbalance the price that they were charging. It's simply not worth it. So in response to people calling the bluff of this high-priced education, what the top schools have done is say, okay, we will pay for the entire education if you qualify as one of the, you know, top 1% of the top 1%. But below that, people are still expected to pay the cost until they call that bluff at places like Notre Dame, places that are lower on the food chain. Faculties at state universities emulated their betters at elite universities by avoiding teaching and concentrating on research, which became more and more controlled by grants, necessitating the hiring of more faculty, which, even at the coolie wages that an army of adjuncts earns, drove prices up even further. At a certain point, education made no sense anymore. Harvard's financial aid is one indication of that. Brooklyn Existentialism is another. And this is the book he's reviewing. Brooklyn Existentialism is a protest against the current intellectual state of affairs, written from the other end of the educational spectrum, which is to say, from two professors who have spent their lives teaching at a small regional Catholic college in Brooklyn and in the public educational system of New York. Nino Langulli, I'm going to guess at how that's pronounced, L-A-N-G-I-U-L-L-I. Nino Langulli was born in Brooklyn on October 9, 1932. He spent most of his life teaching at St. Francis College in Brooklyn, but all of his life as part of the American education machine. Arthur D. Clementi, his co-author, was Langulli's student. And like his mentor, D. Clementi has spent his entire life within the American educational machine, first as a math teacher in the New York public school system, and then following Langulli's footsteps as a professor at St. Francis College. The careers of Langulli and D. Clementi paralleled that of John Taylor Gatto, another Italian immigrant 3 years Langulli's junior, who is also involved in education in New York City, an occupation Gatto describes as spending his life, quote, as a technician in the human rat cage we call public education. Unlike Gatto's underground history of American education, the book Brooklyn Existentialism is not so much an expose of bad policies as a vade mecum for students who need an antidote to the bad ideas they will contract during their 4 overpriced years in college. And I'm not sure exactly, vade mecum, I know what that means, but I can't think of it offhand. I think he's saying it's basically an apology. It's like, here's the antidote to the garbage you're going to learn in school in which I teach. In over a half a century spent in front of students, Langulli and D. Clementi have witnessed what they describe as, quote, the long march of radical democratization and the accompanying decline of manners in speech, courtesy in behavior, and propriety in dress, together with the rise of vulgarity, has led the seduced to imagine themselves as independent and unique. So we've got a couple of Italian Americans from Brooklyn who've taught in local Catholic colleges there and public schools. They've seen the same thing the rest of us have, the great decline, and that's Herbert Marcuse is a Jew communist term, the long march through the institutions. They've seen that over the last 50 years, been a part of it directly, just as has John Taylor Gatto, who is the main one referred to me, the white nationalist, and also by the libertarians, who describes the background and origins of public schooling, what it was intended to accomplish, part of which we'll talk about today, and Jones talks about in his article, and we've discussed more of the 19th century origin of that, but Jones talks more about the testing in this particular article, as we'll get to. Now let me check something here. Okay, we've been going about an hour here. I think we're going to go another half hour today. Not feeling quite as talkative as I normally do, but we're going to run another at least half hour, and then we will wrap this article up next time on Tuesday. Today's Thursday. I should have said the date. Thursday, November 13th is when we're recording this, and we will complete this article next Tuesday at our regular time. But anyway, so Langulli and D. Clementi are like their fellow Italian-American or German-Italian-American John Taylor Gatto in what they've seen and their reaction to it. And they say, the long march, I'll just read that sentence again, the long march of radical democratization and the accompanying decline of manners in speech, courtesy in behavior, and propriety in dress, together with the rise of vulgarity, has led the seduced, that is the student suckers, TV-watching student-suckers, led them to imagine themselves as independent and unique, even though they're actually herd creatures, I throw in there. The main bad idea the authors confront is the primacy of knowing over being that has dethroned ontology, or metaphysics, and put epistemology, a dwarf in king's robes, in its place. Cut off from being, students wander through an intellectual world that is nothing more than a hall of mirrors. Constantly told that whatever they have to say is an opinion, the students succumb to sullen withdrawal when they realize that ultimately power is the ultimate criterion of which opinions matter. Everything is a matter of opinion, yet some opinions are more equal than others, and those opinions which are more equal than others are those held by the powers that be. The powers that be are Jewish. They are manifested in Zog through Zog, and they produce Ameriquois, which is the long decline. It's the fruit of the long decline, or the end state of the long march through the institutions, the long decline of culture that these guys are observing, that all of us are observing, whether we're German, Italian, American, whatever, whether we're Catholics or white nationalists, we are seeing the same thing. If we have slightly different but largely similar explanations of its root cause. This is why we spend so much time on Jones, because he's basically right about this stuff. Even if he downplays the racial aspect of it. Now, you'll see conservatives often denounce relativism since at least the 80s, and the idea of moral relativism or relativism and everything else. You'll often hear people say, well, that's just your opinion. And they've been denied the knowledge that facts differ from opinion. And that's what Crichton was trying to get at in his objection to environmentalism as religion. There's facts and there's opinions, and they're two different things. But in environmentalism, as in media, as in education, we see them constantly conflated, so that the very notion of objective truth is done away with by the leftists. And they have to do away with it because the objective truth is what is that what they're saying is wrong in so many particular instances, whether it's relating to IQ or black violence or whatever. What they're saying is wrong, and they can't afford to have that acknowledged. They have to play down objective truth because it's not in their favor. So, all opinions, like the pigs in Animal Farm, are equal, but some are more equal than others. When they go to college, students are taught not to seek the truth, but to respect the opinions of the powerful. Existentialism, as Langlois and DiClemente use the term, should not be confused with the school of nihilism advanced in France after World War II by people like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, and popularized in the cafes of Greenwich Village. Just as Greenwich Village is the polar opposite of Brooklyn in the world of New York, so Langlois and DiClemente's existentialism is the opposite of Sartre's. Theirs affirms the primacy of being over thought, whereas Sartre's uses existence as a way to attack the notion of essence. I don't fully understand what he's saying here, but being, according to Langlois and DiClemente, is above all else rooted, which means being rooted in a particular place, hence the Brooklyn part of the title. But that's not all of it. Brooklyn, by which we mean ethnic Brooklyn, from, let's say, 1890 to 1990, especially in the years of its flowering in the decades around World War II, had a largely specific content because of the largely Italian and Jewish ethnics who came from southern and eastern Europe to settle in there in those years did not cease to be who they were when they left Ellis Island. They carried with them the household gods of Sicily and Calabria, or Vilnius and Minsk, which could trace their lineage back to the cradle of classical civilization, or its antithesis. What Langlois and DiClemente call Brooklyn existentialism is both particular and universal, in the same way that ancient Athens was when Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle lived there. Brooklyn existentialism bespeaks their effort, quote, to restore the practical and theoretical wisdom of the Hebrews, Greeks, and Romans as synthesized in Christianity in a way that could be called Brooklyn-esque, which is to say, by treating, quote, the ruling bad ideas with dismissive ridicule, just as VNN does, by affirming, quote, the combination of street wisdom and traditional thought, and by defending morality without being moralistic. As such, Brooklyn existentialism is the mortal enemy of fads like multiculturalism and other contemporary expressions of social studies, which do no more than cut students off from Western civilization's tradition rooted in ancient Greek philosophy, Roman law, and Judeo-Christian morality. Cut off from this tradition, students are set adrift on a sea of cultural relativism, a worldview that encourages them to satisfy their immediate desires and explore their narrow interest while dismissing the development of character, responsibility, and intelligence. Brooklyn existentialism is necessary because over the past 20 years, academe in America has become increasingly hostile to every expression of anything resembling ontological stability or transcendence. Everything postmodern is man-confected opinion. In proposing Brooklyn existentialism as the antidote to our educational and intellectual malaise, Langlois and DiClemente deconstruct the deconstructors exposing the innate ontological contradictions in statements like, quote, "We can't be sure of anything," and its more sophisticated variants. For over 50 years in the classroom, both men have seen how the American educational elite, quote, "when confronted with critical common sense realism and with sound arguments it is unable to defeat, banishes its adversaries, nay foes, to an historical reliquary that is beyond the pale of legitimate debate." They can't argue with you, but they can suppress you because they have the power. And that's precisely what they do, both to men and to ideas. We saw this week David Duke and his people from Stormfront tried to rent a hotel, and when a leftist head of the local Peace and Justice Center, whatever, published the name of the hotel's manager and of his wife and children and had his people call them up and threaten them, the FBI did nothing. Whereas when Bill White published the name of the queer Jew who was head of the foreman of the jury that railroaded Matt Hale, Bill White was thrown into prison because of that. Same actions, two different consequences. What the Jews who control America are trying to do is stamp out the men and ideas that threaten them. Stamp them out by suppressing them, by keeping them out of their papers, and by ridiculing the people who give birth to them. Stamp out the very race so that there's not even a basis for any, there's not even any fertile ground from which opposition to Jews might be grown. They want to get rid of white people. Not just specific men and specific ideas. They want to get rid of the entire racial milieu from which opposition to the Jews can even arise. That's what the Jews running our country want to do. And that's what these Italians are writing about in Brooklyn Existentialism and what German-Irish Jones is writing about in Culture Wars. Having been assigned their place in the vast machine known as education, Langulli and DiClemente demur, opining, "We just don't know our place." That the WASP ruling class had a place assigned for Italian immigrants like Langulli and DiClemente is not ethnic paranoia. It is a matter of the historical record, says Jones. 4 years after the stock market crash of 1929, and 14 years after the conclusion of America's first war on European soil, a war which most Americans considered catastrophic for America, the esteem with which the nation held the WASP ruling class had plummeted to an all-time low. Instead of seeing them as a class of vigorous sportsmen like Teddy Roosevelt, the vast majority of Americans saw the WASP elite as fat cats in striped pants continuing to prosper financially at the same time that millions of Americans had plunged into grinding poverty. With this in mind, the Harvard overseers decided that it was time for a change at the helm of the nation's most prestigious university. No one at that time could conceive of looking beyond the WASP gene pool for a candidate, but in choosing James Conant Bryant as Harvard's new president, the Harvard Board of Overseers made a break with tradition by choosing a scientist instead of a man of letters. Bryant was a chemist who had earned his spurs during World War I by experimenting with poison gas. James Conant Bryant. Now he was going to reform Harvard by applying the same scientific principles to the nation's teenagers. One of the things that troubled Conant most was the caliber of student at Harvard, where the overwhelming majority of students were drawn from WASP academies like Groton, founded by Endicott Peabody, the scion of Puritan Boston, who spent time in England as a youth and came back with the idea of recreating the world of Tom Brown's school days on American soil. The graduates of Groton and all of its imitators learned that sports were just as, if not more, important than academic subjects in creating the WASP ideal known as character. But Conant, having been influenced by the promise of scientific testing, was more interested in intelligence than character, which as of the early decades of the 20th century was seen as an inherent, immutable, biologically conditioned attribute of the brain. And that's what it is, regardless of what Jones thinks. The Frenchman Binet had come up with an instrument to measure the new je ne sais quoi, and it became known as the IQ test. Shortly after taking over as president of Harvard, Conant called a dean by the name of Henry Chauncey into his office and told him if he wanted to create a new kind of scholarship at Harvard, this scholarship would, quote, "would be an honor based solely on academic promise," unquote. He's citing Nicholas Lehman, The Big Test, page 28. Conant was a radical in the mold of Thomas Jefferson, whose letter on a natural aristocracy he quoted repeatedly throughout his career as one of America's most influential educators at a time when fundamental changes were afoot in America's educational system. In his letter to John Adams, Jefferson wrote, quote, this is Thomas Jefferson writing to John Adams, I agree with you that there is a natural aristocracy among men. May we not even say that that form of government is the best which provides the most effectually for a pure selection of these natural aristoi, or aristocrats, into the offices of government? Given that fact, Jefferson and Adams were faced with a challenge. How could they guarantee that worth and genius would be sought out from every condition of life and completely prepared by education for defeating the competition of wealth and birth for public trusts? That is, they're trying to find smart people, rake the geniuses out of the rabble, and install them to lead the public, rather than simply people of wealth and birth. The answer to that question, to use Jefferson's words, was, quote, raking geniuses from the rubbish, educating them at public expense, and then installing them in positions of influence in the halls of power. And that's what he wanted to do in his University of Virginia. In his notes on the state of Virginia, Jefferson proposed that 20 of the best geniuses will be raked from the rubbish annually and be instructed at the public expense. The irony here, of course, says Jones, is that Jefferson's dream has been fulfilled, not at the leveling state universities of the sort he founded in the University of Virginia, but at elite bastions of privilege like Harvard and Yale. Jefferson wanted to create a natural elite, but the only way to square that circle was to ensure that it was based not on inherited privilege, but on something God-given or natural, like intelligence. According to Lehman, the new elite's essential quality would be brains. At this point, another question insinuates itself, namely, how do you rake the geniuses from the rubbish? Jefferson had no answer to that question, and it was not until the WASP ruling class had lost its faith in Christ and replaced it with an even more fervent faith in scientific testing that they felt emboldened enough to come up with their own answer. Science offered in mental testing a way of selecting the country's deserving new leaders. The SAT, in other words, would finally make it possible the creation of a natural aristocracy. Unfortunately, by the time James Bryant Conant had his epiphany about creating the natural aristocracy at Harvard, the people who had created the test that would enable Conant to rake through the rubbish were having their doubts. Carl Brigham, author of A Study of American Intelligence, was one of the creators of the standardized test, as well as a fervent devotee of the eugenics movement. During the 1920s, the eugenics movement and the movement for standardizing testing were two sides of the same coin. People like Brigham and his friend Madison Grant feared that the wave of Southern and Eastern European immigration, which swept over America from 1880 until 1920, and that included millions of Jews, was bringing about a dilution of the native stocks and a consequent reduction in intelligence, and that's why they passed the 1924 Immigration Act, which limited newcomers to their percentage of the stocks already in the country, in order to preserve the character of America as a Northwestern European descended group. Proof of this could be found in the results of the IQ test, which Brigham, working under the direction of the primatologist Robert Yerkes, Y-E-R-K-E-S, administered to the Army during World War I. Like Grant, his mentor in racial matters, Brigham believed that Europe was made up of three distinct white races, the Nordic, the Alpine, and the Mediterranean, in descending order of intelligence. When Brigham administered his IQ test to the Army, he found, mirabile dictu, miraculous to say, he found the intelligence results tracked perfectly with racial, national, and class characteristics. Quoting Brigham, on the Army IQ test, Nordics scored higher than Alpines, who scored higher than Mediterraneans. The test results were like a photograph of American culture, so faithfully did they reproduce the social order. Officers scored higher than enlisted men, the native-born scored higher than the foreign-born, and whites scored higher than Negroes. There were ironclad natural laws at work here, Brigham felt, and he warned that wishful thinkers who pretended otherwise were deluding themselves, writing, for example, quote, our figures, then, would rather tend to disprove the popular belief that the Jew is highly intelligent. Brigham's stern conclusion was this: American intelligence is declining and will proceed at an accelerating rate as the racial admixture becomes more and more extensive. These are the plain, if somewhat ugly, facts that our study shows. And that was Lehman citing Brigham, not Brigham himself. If we read between the lines here, it becomes clear that the IQ test provided a perfect mirror of the social order in America. This quote-unquote fact, of course, was open to more than one interpretation, says Jones. It might be seen as proof that America had the perfect social order, in which each man found the niche that perfectly suited his natural gifts. But it could also be taken to show that what the test tested was familiarity with the mores and vocabulary of the ruling class elites who designed the test. And see, Jones, I don't agree with Jones here. He's denouncing the test, but the test has, in fact, proved that it is a good predictor of academic success, which is what it purports to be. And even that's true even more for blacks than for whites, even though the test was originally not designed to... it wasn't devised and written the way it is now, in which it deliberately downplays white culture in favor of minority culture. If that were the case, that it was designed for those familiar with the ruling class mores, it would come as no surprise that those who were raised in that environment and most familiar with its vocabulary would score the highest in standardized tests of this sort. Jones is making the argument that is typically made by the leftists and Jews he opposes, which is that the white-black differential in scoring is based in culture and environment rather than innate ability. Again, Jones is a Catholic, and he has a very strong, pronounced hatred of biological fact, which he always smears as determinism. Genes exist, whether or not E. Michael Jones can handle that emotionally. The IQ test, it turns out, was not a test of intelligence or innate ability, but rather familiarity with the world of the people who designed the test. If it tested for anything, it was probably conversation at the dinner table. If the conversation at your dinner table was similar to the conversation at Carl Brigham's, your child would do well in the test. If you did not have dinner table conversations because your mother was off working somewhere, you probably would not do well in the test. Eventually, Brigham came to this very conclusion. In 1930, he stood up at a eugenics conference and issued a formal recantation of just about all of the fundamental beliefs of intelligence testing. At another point in the year, he published a formal retraction of his most famous book, A Study of American Intelligence, calling it an exercise in psychophrenology. Phrenology is the pseudoscience by which you determine the brain's character by feeling the skull bumps. It was popular, I believe, in the 1700s. So he called IQ testing an exercise in psychophrenology, pretentious and, quote-unquote, without foundation. According to Brigham's new view, the scores that derive from the standardized IQ test, quote, very definitely are a composite, including schooling, family background, familiarity with English, and everything else relevant and irrelevant. Now again, what we have here is Jones basically following the leftist in using the fact that some IQ tests might have been imperfectly devised to say that all IQ testing is invalid. Jones is wrong. What they did not track was the Fata Morgana known as quote-unquote native intelligence. It seems like Jones is making a leftist argument here that there is no such thing as native intelligence or general intelligence, but that has been shown to be false. In fact, if anything, the results of his years of involvement in standardized testing proved to Carl Brigham that, quote, the native intelligence hypothesis is dead. It was precisely at this moment of maximal disillusionment when Henry Chauncey showed up at Carl Brigham's door in Princeton University. In typically American fashion, Chauncey decided that what Brigham thought about his own test didn't matter. And so, once again, an American institution was erected over a non-existent intellectual foundation. But again, that's merely Jones's and Brigham's opinion. Others thought differently, and they had good reason to think differently. In order to get into Harvard in the era before the SAT, students had to take a week-long battery of essay tests, tests which showed how well the student could write, his ability to organize material, and gave a fair amount of insight into just what he knew. Essay tests were what the profession called achievement tests. They indicated how proficient a student was at a certain skill. State driver's license exams and fiddle contests are achievement tests. Unfortunately, given the grand schemes of the nascent testing industry, the essay exam was a labor-intensive operation. It took a long time to grade, and it had to be graded by someone who was himself fairly proficient at the skill he was grading, which meant that there was a relatively small school of graders that the testers could draw from. Grading exams was also subjective, one of the worst cuss words in the scientific testing crowd's lexicon. Worst of all, the essay exam, as the basis for the original college boards, was deemed insufficiently scientific. Moreover, it couldn't be graded by machines, which meant that it could not be administered to millions of students at a shot and evaluated a short time later. So what he's essentially arguing here is the fact that mass standardized, scientifically machine capable testing is easier is the reason that it came to be adopted, whereas a better way would have been the old way, which is more complex and involved process, but nevertheless one that measured it, gave a better, truer picture of the individual's capabilities and intelligence. The essay test was also, and he's not necessarily wrong in that either, he may well be right. The essay test was also inextricably bound up with content and skills. Ultimately, Conant found it unacceptable because it didn't measure, quote, aptitude, unquote, or, quote, intelligence, unquote, the naked Ding an sich, or the German term for thing in itself. But, of course, it's probably difficult to measure. If any time you're using a word, you're using something that's cultural rather than innate. But from what I've read, they have found that a good rough test of IQ is you can place in front of the subject that you're testing a series of light bulbs with buttons under them, and you light up random lights and you measure how quickly the subject is able to press the button under the light that you just lit up, and the speed with which he or she is able to do that is pretty much as good a measure of his IQ as anything. Think about that. In their quest for the philosopher's stone, the thing that will give all the answers, or the thing in itself, the general intelligence measure, Conant and Chauncey ignored Brigham's misgivings and decided to overlook the test's shortcomings and focus instead on the fact that someone had invented a machine that could read the electrical charge on a graphite mark on a test sheet. And those would be the, you know, SAT, the little ovals you fill in on those tests. Ignoring the warnings of the test's inventor, Henry Chauncey announced that he had now had a test that gave an accurate account of quote-unquote native intelligence, which could now be administered to millions of Americans simultaneously and graded in a matter of days. The results of that test would create a national personnel pool that could be put to use rationally and effectively. The SAT was created by Harvard to find bright children in the Midwest, like Jones's kids. Those boys were to be whisked away to places like Harvard to become the administrators of the American Empire. The SAT test was an IQ test of quote-unquote ability, which ranked the entire nation on one numeric scale. According to Lehman, standardized educational tests created a ranking of Americans one by one from top to bottom on a single measure. Once the Educational Testing Service of Princeton, New Jersey made this claim, quote, intelligence tests were huckstered in school district after school district. Fortunes accrued to well-placed pedagogical leaders and their political allies. Every child would now be given a magical number, ranking it scientifically in the great race of life. School grades might vary according to the whim of teachers, but IQ scores were unvarying, an emotionless badge of biological honor or shame, marking innate, almost unchanging ability. James Conant could have chosen achievement tests as the criterion of admission to Harvard, but he was totally committed to the idea of an aptitude test, an IQ test, because it corresponded so perfectly with the idea of the natural aristocracy he had appropriated from Thomas Jefferson. Conant was part of a generation who felt that they had placed their hands on the throat of the thing itself, nature, reality, whatever you wanted to call it, and that that thing itself was nothing more than little balls bumping into each other at various rates of speed. So Jones is starting to go back to his anti-enlightenment, anti-materialist views. The SAT, according to this view, measured the RPMs of the intellectual machine that was otherwise known as the brain, to say anything else, to say that intelligence was another word for acquired skills, was to betray the high calling of science. And Conant was not going to do that, even if Brigham had exposed the inadequacy of his own test. Brigham was also against granting any organization proprietary rights to a test that was this politically important, because he correctly foresaw that, quote, any organization that owned the rights to a particular test would inevitably become more interested in promoting it than in honestly researching its effectiveness, unquote. Once any test became this powerful, it would have a deforming effect on school curricula across the country, which would abandon traditional disciplines in favor of tutoring for the test. And this is a widespread complaint today, that kids are taught to the test. Is this going to be on the test rather than taught what they need to know? That meant, in Brigham's words, that, quote, English will be taught for reading alone, and that practice and drill in the writing of English will disappear. Rather than take Brigham's misgivings to heart and attempt to come up with a test that answered his objections, Conant and Chauncey chose to ignore the messenger who bore the bad news. This became easier to do on January 24, 1943, when Brigham died at the age of 52. In ignoring Brigham's warnings, Conant was, in a certain sense, only responding to the needs of the classes that made him head of Harvard in the first place. The WASP ruling class learned that production on a massive scale, not superior weapons or tactics, were what brought about the defeat of fascism in World War II. That is, the Germans were better. It's been estimated they were 50% better than the next most effective soldiers, but they lost because they couldn't produce on a large enough scale to offset the production of the Allies, that is, Russia and America. And it now looked as if the same thing were going to decide the Cold War as well. Consolidation, large economies of scale, corporate socialism, turning America into a mirror image of the Soviet Union it purported to oppose, this was the only way America could triumph in the Cold War, especially after the disappointment engendered by the Russian launch of Sputnik in 1957, which led to a bunch of federal spending for science and math, and the fear that we were falling behind the Soviets and they were going to be able to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles and defeat us. And so Conant became a devoted proponent of both the consolidated high school and the standardized test. The net result of these innovations in the educational life in America was, according to John Taylor Gatto, quote, the destruction of small town, small government America, strong families, individual liberties, and a lot of other things people weren't aware they were trading for a regular corporate paycheck, unquote. Local independence in educational matters was something that the United States could no longer afford, not if it wanted to defeat the Soviet Union in the Cold War. After the Russians launched Sputnik in 1957, Conant announced that it was the small size of our schools causing the problem. The combination of standardized testing and school consolidation that Conant was proposing as the solution to that problem meant that authority was taken away from the actual teachers standing in front of students from a local community and was invested in experts far away. Remember now, the feds first got into education, local education, in a large way in the 60s under LBJ, and they started pumping billions of dollars into K-12 education. And of course, along with money comes control. If they're giving you money, they're going to control what you're taught and how you're taught. So, the idea here is that consolidation and economies of scale is necessary to defeat Nazi Germany and will be necessary to defeat the Soviet Union. We've got to standardize everything through Washington, centralize and consolidate, including a national scientific testing and national educational agenda setting, taking that power away from the local community where it has traditionally resided, even in the public schools. So the experts that the new control is going to be vested in are far away. They determine what gets taught according to the interests of those who qualified as scientific, says Jones, meaning professional organizations like the NEA and the personnel needs of burgeoning empire, and not the local community. Conant had always considered the neighborhood context of most schools as one of the main obstacles to the effective centralization of educational management. Consolidation was the way of the future, and clearly, he wrote, the total process is irreversible. Reading Conant, Gatto tells us, is like overhearing a private conversation not meant for you, yet fraught with the greatest personal significance. Hearing someone else talking about what they're going to do to you. One of the moments occurs in Conant's 1949 book, The Child, the Parent, and the State, when he informs us that the transformation of America's schools had been ordered by, quote, certain industrialists and the innovative who were altering the nature of the industrial process, unquote. In spite of the misgivings of the man who created the test went forward. In spite of Brigham's fears that the ownership of the test would lead to the suppression of any evidence of its shortcomings, a corporation was founded with proprietary rights over the test that would determine the destiny of Americans for generations to come. On January 1, 1948, Henry Chauncey launched Educational Testing Services at Princeton, former home of the late Carl Brigham. Lehman sees the founding of ETS as, quote, one of the periodic high points of faith and the power of reason. Quoting Lehman, expertise and logic were taken to be almost limitlessly fruitful. Expertise and logic were taken to be almost limitlessly fruitful. The first computer had just been unveiled. The new United Nations would end war. The disease that had crippled the privileged President Roosevelt was on the verge of being eliminated as a threat to even the poorest of the poor. No problem, no source of woe, no unsolved mystery seemed immune to the miraculous good effects of human intervention through technology and organization. Henry Chauncey, the man who would measure your mind, felt that humanity had, quote, arrived at the period in man's history when the human affairs can be studied as impartially and scientifically as physical phenomena. ETS was going to do to the mind what the Manhattan Project had done to the atom. ETS was going to decode the mind so that man could map and code the personality. Once the mind had been decoded, rational understanding would replace prejudice, hatred, emotion, and superstition. Again, this is like Skinner and the rest of these sinus clowns who are going to basically take away everything that's good from human and turn them into a clockwork orange, as Anthony Burgess called it in his novel, from which the movie you might have seen was made. No free will, everything is going to be determined. All is a matter of conditioning and teaching and inculcation. But they won't stop us from being us, because we is us and we ain't changing. Human nature itself would be reformed. So, to read that quote again, once the mind had been decoded, rational understanding would replace prejudice, hatred, emotion, and superstition. Human nature itself would be reformed. Scientific testing would then serve as a substitute for religion, which could never be fully effective in improving society because it was not scientific. It is no coincidence that Henry Chauncey was the scion of Puritan ministers who came to America to create a city on a hill, their term for heaven on earth. Henry Chauncey was finally going to succeed where his forebears had failed because, as he put it, the social sciences are at last freeing themselves from the bondage in which they have been held by ethics, religion, prejudices, and value judgments. So again, we see earlier in today's lecture we saw that religion could be used for bad, but now we're seeing the flip side, that science can be used for bad. And I would say that the only thing that will reconcile these two is it doesn't matter whether you call it science or you call it religion, you have to test it against reality. And of course someone else will come and say, well, that itself is a bias, objective reality doesn't exist. But for practical purposes, you have to act as though it does, and it's very dangerous not to. That's my religious scientific view. We're almost done here, and we as I said, we'll pick it up on Tuesday. We got another 10 pages of the article to go. I'm going to finish this little subtitle, and then we'll close it out with a little more talk. ETS and its standardized tests were going to ensure that the anarchy that presently exists to the confusion and unhappiness of most people would be replaced by a sense of order. As the head of ETS, Chauncey had become the high priest of the new American religion of compulsory education. Quote, "What I hope to see established is the moral equivalent of religion, but based on reason and science rather than on sentiments and tradition." In order to implement his bold new plan, Conant had to confront other daunting challenges as well. The first and most significant was the decentralized nature of American public education. In order to rake through the rubbish, Conant had to troll through students scattered among 15,000 local high school boards across the country, each of which had its own standards of what was important. Secondly, Conant had to confront the precipitous decline in intellectual standards that took place in American public schools during the period beginning in the 1930s. The SATs had become necessary for elite universities like Harvard because during Conant's tenure there, public high schools had become less and less reliable as educational institutions. The Second World War had, as World War I had a generation earlier, granted the psychometricians another opportunity to measure the American mind, but what they discovered when they did proved to be unsettling. During the 10-year period between 1941 and 1951, when expenditure in public education was on the rise, literacy in the draft pool dropped from 96 to 81%. By 1970, it would drop to 73%. In spite of the fact that America was spending four times as much money in real dollars on education than it had when World War II encouraged more government funding of education. So they're spending four times as much, but literacy is dropping. The ominous trend that emerged during the testing of GIs during the 1940s quickly became a rule of thumb. The more money the nation spent on public education, the fewer the people who learned how to read. And that's where we're going to leave it for Thursday, November 13th, year of our Lord, 2008. I'm Alex Linder. This is Radio Estina. We will be back with you next Tuesday, and we will conclude this article discussing changes in American culture and education, the educational establishment in specific. And we'll have some other different news items that we want to talk about. I'll also have some thoughts about writing a book and publishing a book, which has been discussed on the forum recently. And for those of you who are listening to this for the first time, welcome, and please join vnnforum.com. If you're a stable, solid, serious person, you're welcome to pass this URL around. We have an archivist who puts this all together and has it up as an MP3 within 24 hours, downloadable from govnn.com and also posted at vnnforum.com. And I am behind on my notes there, but I will get that caught up in the next few days. I want to thank you for listening. This is Radio Estina. I'm Alex Linder, and I'll be with you again on Tuesday. Good night.